It is a 650, 1320 WILS. You know, resilience is important at any stage of life, but in midlife, it can be even more so and even more challenging to be resilient. Adam Grant is one of the country's top thought leaders on this topic. He's a management and psychology professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, author, co-author of the book Option B, Facing Adversity, Building Resilience, and Finding Joy. Adam, it is great to have you on WILS.
Great to be back as a native Detroiter.
Oh, yeah. And what did you live in Michigan for a long time then? Or?
I did. I think 22 years.
Okay. And then you left. And have you been back? Or do you have family in Michigan?
Yep. Have family there. Get back every year or so.
Okay. Not too long of a drive, I guess, right, from where you are?
Nope.
Yeah.
Not too bad.
When you think about midlife resilience, what's the biggest challenge for people once they get to middle age to really have strong resilience?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges that we see over and over again is around middle age, people start to think much more about the meaning and their purpose in life than they had before. And so, you know, when they start to face hardship, when they encounter adversity of all kinds, one of the things they need to do is they need to be able to say, look, you know, I may be suffering, but this suffering, there's a reason behind it, and it's going to put me in a position to be able to do some good. Mm-hmm. And people who are able to do that end up finding a lot more strength than people who don't.
Okay, so you need to have some kind of a purpose, you're saying. Is it typically, what, their family and children? Is that a key thing people lean on for resilience? Or?
Yeah, typically the three biggest sources of purpose are our family, especially children and spouse, of course. The second is work, and the third is religion, in no particular order. Hmm. And it doesn't seem to matter a huge amount which one people draw on, as one of them, as long as one of them is a major source of meaning.
Hmm. So, if you don't have religion in your life, is that a detriment to your ability to be resilient in some way?
Well, there is evidence that people who are strongly religious end up feeling more resilient in the face of crisis and difficulty, because they feel like, you know, there's some order, there's some coherence. They don't need to understand necessarily why is this happening to me, but that doesn't mean if you're not religious, you can't be resilient. It just means that you're going to end up looking to other places to try to make sense of what's going on in your life.
Hmm. And when you use the word resilience, what's your real definition of that word?
So we think about resilience as the strength and speed of your response to adversity. So when something goes wrong in your life, how fast do you bounce back and how much do you recover?
Okay. How fast should you be able to bounce back?
I think we need to take the shoulds out of the resilience conversation. I think, you know, for people facing loss or illness or, you know, for that matter, job loss, there's often a lot of pressure that they face to feel like, okay, I should be done with that grief thing, or, you know, I should no longer be depressed or anxious. And, you know, the reality is that everybody ends up going through struggles in their own time, in their own way. And so I think, you know, it's one thing to say, I want to be able to get through this faster. It's another to say, well, here's the proper time, and if you don't make it in this window, then you're not strong.
Yeah, well, it seems that if you're truly resilient, you'd have to be able to compartmentalize, right? You have to be able to block certain human emotions, maybe, to push through. So how does that fit into being resilient and being healthy, then?
Yeah, it's something that comes up a lot. So one of the things that psychologists have found for years is, there are these three traps that we fall into when something goes bad in our lives. One is what's called pervasiveness, which is feeling like, you know, when something's not going well at work, it's going to ruin every part of my life. And then there's also personalization. This is all my fault. And permanence is always going to feel this bad.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ways that people find resilience is they try to basically reject those beliefs and say, look, you know, this is not going to ruin every part of my life forever, and this is not always going to be my fault. And, you know, the quicker you can get out of that trap, the easier it is then to cope and move forward.
So you just have to tell yourself that, essentially, and believe it?
I think it's often hard for people to tell themselves that, but one thing they can do is they can actually pay attention to the fluctuations in their own emotional experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you may notice throughout the course of a week that not every moment was equally awful. And that starts to remind you, look, you know what, just because this feels bad doesn't mean it feels equally bad in every single situation, and maybe it will get better.
Yeah, the personal part, that's got to be tricky because, you know, especially if it's something that really is personal, let's say you get fired because of your performance, right? That's pretty personal at that point.
That's where self-compassion often comes in. So the psychologist Kristen Neff has some really cool research on this that says, look, you know what, when something is your fault, you need to give yourself the same kindness and understanding that you would give to a good friend. And say, look, yeah, you know what, it might be your fault that you got fired, but you should also think about whether this organization was not the best fit. Because most of the time when something goes wrong in a relationship, whether it's you and another person or you and an employer, it's not you, it's not them, it's us. Right? There are multiple parties in that relationship. And so then, you know, you say, look, self-compassion is about realizing that other people have been in situations just like this. Mm-hmm. It's only human to fail, and that doesn't mean I won't be able to get back on my feet in the next few months.
Adam Grand right here on WILS. His book is Option B, Facing Adversity, Building Resilience, and Finding Joy. So how do you know when you're really, you've crossed the line and you're just feeling sorry for yourself and you really do need to buck up? You know, you say there's no shoulds in the conversation, but how do you know when you've hit that point?
I think the usual test is whether it's starting to interfere with your daily functioning. So, you know, if it's really affecting your relationships, you know, your ability to go to work, if it's taking a huge toll on your mood and happiness, that's when, you know, people often start to tell themselves, well, okay, I need to do something to break out of this.
Okay. And that, now, if you is this the kind of thing where it's a skill that you have through your life, once you've developed it, it's always there, or is this a different kind of thing, having this resilience?
So we think that resilience operates a lot like a muscle. And, you know, as you build it up, as you exercise it, it becomes stronger. But it's also possible for that muscle to atrophy. And so, you know, if you develop these skills after a difficult situation, you don't use them for a couple decades, they might be a little bit rustier than they were when you first learned them.
You're almost saying that if things are really good, that's not a good thing.
Well, I hate to say that, you know, that anybody should should feel bad about things being good.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I think the interesting thing is there's a real case to be made for everyday resilience. Right? Nobody's life is perfect. Everybody lives some form of option B, where, you know, option A is the way that you were hoping things would turn out, and option B is the reality that you're stuck with. And I think you can practice the skills of resilience in those moments when, you know, you have a disappointment at work, a small failure, you have a tough moment at home where, you know, you don't handle an argument with your kids the way you wanted to. Those are all situations where you can work on the same skills that are often relevant for bigger crises.
Yeah. Do you think limiting your emotions to the point where you're not letting your emotions kind of control you too much, is that part of being resilient?
You know, it goes back and forth on this. I think the overwhelming evidence says that the most important thing to do is to accept your emotions as you experience them. Mm-hmm. Because the moment that you start to fight them is the moment where you begin to say, okay, you know, I was mad, and now I'm mad. I was nervous, and now I'm getting really nervous, and I'm going to feel nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And then the emotions start to compound themselves. If you accept them and say, you know what, yeah, you know, I'm feeling really depressed right now, then you start to say, all right, that's okay. Depression serves a function. It broadens our field of vision. It helps us reexamine our priorities. And as long as I don't get stuck in that, you know, that state for a long time, I'm going to let myself feel it as opposed to immediately try to overcome it.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of resilient people I've known, they tend to not be highly emotional. They're tough, you know. Is that the same kind of quality as resilience in your view?
I think it can be. So when we think about what it means to be resilient, you know, being able to, you know, to go through sort of ups and downs without being on an emotional roller coaster is one way that you could describe it. There may be a difference, though, between, you know, the emotions they display and the ones that they feel.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the most resilient people we know, they end up sort of, they look like on the surface, they're just calm and cool and collected. But that doesn't mean they're not grappling with difficult emotions internally.
Hmm. You said the things that really are anchors for people are their family, their work, and religion. And the way things are now with work, does it really remain such an anchor for people for their resilience?
Yeah, it turned out to be a huge source of identity for a lot of people. So you know, if you think about the last time you met somebody at a party, when you introduce yourself, what was the first thing you asked them about them? What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the answer is supposed to be, well, my job is what I do, and that's a reflection of who I am. And you know, certainly, if you're in an unstable economy with a lot of unemployment, it's harder to rely on that. But you do find, it's stunning how many people, and this is true around the world, say, look, you know what? I the first thing I would do if I won the lottery is I would quit my job. And yet the vast majority of people who win the lottery keep on working, which tells you that, you know, either the meaning they find at work, the sense of community they have, the structure it gives to their life, there's something there that keeps them going back. And I don't think we should lose sight of that.
Adam Grant, management and psychology professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Option B, Facing Adversity, Building Resilience, and Finding Joy. Adam, great to have you on WILS. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And that is it for us. We're back tomorrow, 6 p.m. Good night.